Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Liz Scott, author of the new memoir, This Never Happened, from University of Hell Press. Liz is a practicing psychologist in Portland and a practicing writer. Her work has appeared in the MacGuffin, New Stone Circle, and Lake Effect, among other journals, and she's the mother of two grown daughters. This Never Happened is her first book. Margaret Malone writes of This Never Happened, surprising, funny, and impossible to put down. Liz Scott's memoir will break your heart with its calamitous wit and self-awareness. Scott's elusive pursuit of familial truth and belonging haunts every page. Liz Scott, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much, Ken.
Now, Liz, we talked about this before, so I hope it's not considered rude. I want to check with you. You write in the book that whenever someone asks your age, you always answer truthfully, a somewhat gift in reverse from your mother, who had multiple ever-changing answers to that question. You had a birthday just a few weeks ago. Can I ask how old you are?
You can ask, and I will tell. I just turned 72, although if I'm not looking in the mirror, I'm pretty sure I'm 16. Maybe 18?
You actually look about halfway between the two.
Okay, thank you. I will take it. I will take it.
No, you even give your birth date in the book, which is why I asked the question.
I do.
March 27th, 1947. And really, it's the perfect time to write a memoir, reflecting back on a long, momentous life. But we're also living in an age when teenagers are writing memoirs.
Isn't that something?
I know. What are they writing about?
What are they writing about?
Yeah. Recess? I don't know. So I have to ask, why now? Is this something you've been working on for some time?
Yeah. You know, my wonderful old writing teacher, Tom Spanbauer.
The Dangerous Writers Group,
whom I was with for about 10 years, always talked about how important it was to have narrative distance from your work, especially if you're writing something very personal, so it doesn't sound like a diary entry. And so I think part of that is having enough life under your belt to do that, having enough distance from some of the material and working it through with therapists and friends. And also, I couldn't have done this until after my parents died.
You were worried about impinging on their personal space
or revealing things they didn't want revealed? I think so. I think it would have felt too unnecessarily unkind.
And your father died in 1996, your mother in 2005.
Correct. Okay. Yes, correct. And I've been thinking about all of this for a long time, and I've been mulling over these stories and had a lot of people encourage me to write about it. And I think I felt, after my mother died in 2005, particularly freed up, and that's when I started really thinking in earnest about it.
Well, let's get right into the mom.
Okay. Yeah, let's get into the mom.
The main
Always
character.
The root.
Right. You start your book with four epigraphs, and the first one is from Toni Morrison. A woman has to be a daughter before she can be any kind of woman. If she doesn't have that in mind, if she doesn't know how to relate to her ancestors, to her tribe, she's not good for much. Now, my understanding that Morrison is saying there's more to being a daughter than just having parents. Your parents, of course, are the central focus of the book, but in terms of relating to your ancestors, your tribe, you didn't even know who those people were. What resonated in Morrison's quote for you?
Yeah, it was on both the level of me and my mother, and this notion of ancestors. As you say, we never met a single relative, and both my parents were either disowned their own families or were disowned by their families. We still don't know exactly what happened. And so my mother and I think we're just not meant to be mother and daughter. We were sort of a bad match. And so I don't think I was a great daughter. I don't think she was a great mother. And I didn't learn how to be a very good mother from her. And of course, I think I can only surmise that she had some of the same experience with her own mother.
Who you didn't know.
Whom I didn't know, never met.
Your grandmother.
Yeah, my grandmother. And I've just been thinking a lot more about this notion of our ancestors and how forming a lineage somehow is an important part of our development and coming to know who we are as rounded people.
There is a point in the book where you give your ancestry, actually, which goes back hundreds of years. I won't give too much away yet because I want to set up with this kind of false narrative you were growing up with. You have a beautifully lyrical passage on growing up in Connecticut. It sounds like something out of Updike or Cheever, actually, or if Philip Roth was writing about upper-class Gentiles.
Exactly.
I wondered if you could please read that for
us. Sure. In 1947, Princess Elizabeth married Prince Philip, her younger sister Margaret, an attendant. Also in 1947, I, Elizabeth, was born, and in 1953 came my sister Margaret, Elizabeth and Margaret. Could that sound any more Anglican? In our school years, we lived in a bucolic enclave in Connecticut, a commuter's train ride from New York City. We took horseback riding lessons, English saddle, ballet with Miss O'Neill, piano with Ruth Steinkraus, she of the New York Philharmonic, ballroom dancing with Miss Boleyn, Russian, who wore a midnight blue cocktail sheath with black illusion at the bust and played Fascination on the stereo, while we white-gloved boys and girls, those of whom had not gone off to boarding school, learned the foxtrot. Forward, forward, side together, back, back. We started French and Latin in third grade, and every home had both Emily Post and Amy Vanderbilt. We said aunt and tomato. We learned where the fish knife went and the dessert spoon, and that the knife blade always faces the plate. We played croquet and learned bridge. Every year, my mother ran the antique fair at the Northfield Congregational Church, a postcard white, clappered and steepled church on a hill in a postcard of a New England town. And every year, we attended church on Easter and Christmas, my sister and I wearing matching flowered dresses and matching bonnets on our curly heads in spring, Chesterfield coats and white rabbit fur muffs on our cold hands in winter.
My God, I feel like a bologna and mayonnaise sandwich, right? Of course, there's a twist, Liz.
There's a twist.
We find out, as you did, that this is quite a contrast from your true roots, which you weren't yet aware of. Now, I grew up Jewish in New York, and this was something I was always very much aware of.
I'm happy for you.
I can't imagine how it would feel to be told later that everything you knew was wrong. How did you first find out you had Jewish roots, and what were your feelings?
You know, I wish I could remember exactly how I found that out. I mean, there were clues all along, but this kind of vague sense, but nothing that my sister or I ever articulated. And my this is a plot point, but my sister ended up hiring a private detective to find our father, who had left when I was about 10 and rediscovered him when I was in my early 30s. And I think it was at around that time that we began to know more about both our parents' histories. They both come from Jewish families, both in complete denial about that. So I was in my early 30s.
Talking about all these twists and learning things, these buried truths, you have a chapter aptly named the Maginot Line 1963. There's a quote, "I think there must be an internal Maginot Line where our buried truths come up against the concrete fortification that is our defense and denial." You crossed that line, of course, in the book. How did you manage to do that? I mean, some of us never cross that Maginot Line.
It's true. Some of us never do. I mean, I had a harder time than my sister really owning, coming to feel at peace and owning this identity. It took me longer than it took her for some reason. But I've always been committed to, however slow the process, to being on a sort of personal growth path. And I know that I have to confront those defenses if I'm going to do that.
And we'll get into your career as a psychologist and how that has helped you or maybe hindered you in discovering these buried truths. Now, there's one story you tell about your mother, a 10-day cruise you take with her and your sister, Margaret. You write, "Those 10 days will live on as contenders for the worst 10 days of my life." You say that you often tell this when explaining your mother to friends. Can you give us a little bit of that story?
Oh, my God. It was such a nightmare. And
it's told beautifully.
Thank you.
It's almost unbelievable.
It's almost unbelievable. And I don't expect people to feel too sorry for me getting taken on an all-expense-paid Mediterranean cruise.
Right, you know, Croatian coast.
It was, I mean, so she wanted to do this, she said, and she wanted to pay for it. And we reluctantly, because of our history and her quote-unquote gifts to us.
You ended up paying for a lot of her gifts.
We paid a lot. There were a lot of strings attached, and there's a lot of a big emotional price tag. But she would do things like we would go to get her in the morning from her cabin, and she wouldn't answer the door. And we would call the phone, and she wouldn't answer the door. And we would get the steward to come finally let us into her cabin, and she'd be lying there reading a People magazine. And just just, I don't know.
As if nothing was wrong.
As if nothing was wrong. And then she'd decided that she wanted to take the bus tour in Dubrovnik instead of the cable car. And so we would book that. And then the morning we were going to go, she said she didn't feel well and she didn't want to go. And it was just sort of one annoying, vexing difficulty after another. It was every day presented like three or four different challenges like that.
And of course, there's more stories about
yes.
your mom in the book. There are many stories. For your father, though, you have fewer stories mm-hmm. And these memories. And this is a quote from the book near the end. The smell of white shirts after a day in the city, Chopin on the black piano, a sense of his presence in the basement building furniture, darkness and absence. So besides that darkness and that absence, is there something you could tell us, maybe one particularly indelible memory about your dad?
Well, I have.
And of course, you didn't see him all that often.
I didn't.
And as you mentioned, your sister hired the detective to
yes.
find him.
Right. And I saw him twice after that. But I have the only memory I have of him is, and I write this chapter in the book, is when he asked me to, this is after he'd left the home and he was living in New York City, and he asked me to take the train in to meet him for lunch. And I think I was about 11. And at that lunch, he told me that it was too hard for him to see me and he couldn't see me anymore.
That's awful. Yeah.
And
you were must have been crushed.
I must have been.
But you don't remember.
But I don't remember. And I think I was in a, kind of a state of shock. And I had, you know, kids, it's too hard for kids to think of having two quote-unquote bad parents. It's much easier if you can make one into a good parent if the other one is the bad parent.
Right.
And he was absent, and I had more in common with him in some superficial ways, and so I made him into the sort of good invisible parent. And so I think my initial response to that event in New York was to feel sorry for him and feel bad that he was struggling so much.
That shows a lot of compassion rather than feeling sorry for yourself that your father was rejecting you.
I think that's kind of misplaced compassion.
No.
I think I should have had a little bit more compassion for myself, frankly.
Now, you do have a chapter in the book. It consists of just one item on a list. The title of the chapter is What My Father Taught Me. The list reads, Develop an Intense, Abiding Object Hunger for Men. How would you describe that object hunger? And it doesn't seem like the healthiest lesson to take away from a relationship with your
dad.
You're
not kidding.
Certainly not consciously.
No, absolutely not. It was the void that I was ever in search of. So I started getting boy crazy very early, like 13 years old, got very, very boy crazy and stayed very, very, very boy crazy until, I don't know, what day is it? Yesterday? So until maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago, I'd say. I mean, or maybe I'll give myself a break, maybe a little longer than that.
It took a lot of work.
It took a lot of work and a lot of not good relationships and a lot of flailing around in that regard. It was a defining feature for me.
Was that trying to find a man who would take the place of your dad then?
Somebody
more loving and
yes,
more there,
yes,
more present.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Now, much of the book tells the story not only of your relationship with your parents, and we just got into your relationship with your mother and your father, but your mom, Lee, and your dad, August, their relationship to each other. You find something that most of us don't, this trove of letters after their passing. The first few are sweet and loving, as you'd expect, as they got together and got romantic and married. But the latter ones turned very raw and bitter and often cruel. Was this a difficult decision whether to include these? You said earlier that you were waiting till after their passing before writing the book.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't difficult in this context since they were both gone. But I myself was really shocked at the degree of vitriol and bile and bitterness, as you say, in those last letters, especially in contrast with, I only have the letters I have from there early on are only two from my father to my mother, but they're, I don't know if you found this, I found them so beautifully written.
Yes.
So romantic And
yeah, what a contrast.
What a contrast. I mean, the contrast was just shocking. And it really makes you think, you know, how can a relationship go so, so wrong? And I think they both obviously had responsibility for how it went so wrong. They were both very complicated, damaged people.
And there's no heroes and villains in this. If you read the correspondence, they're both very damaged.
Both of them, I think
would say,
that's
very
true.
Responsible for the deterioration
Absolutely.
Of the relationship. Now, you write about your relationship with your mother, which we went to. That's a lot of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And about the decades of anger and frustration and hurt and disappointment. And declare your life task to clear away the shit and grant myself, us both really, the relief of compassion and forgiveness. Is that a task you feel you've achieved or still a task in progress?
I have to say it's a task in progress. I mean, I'm moving along. And even writing the book, even though I certainly did not set out for it to be any kind of a therapeutic exercise, I did find that when I finished, my compassion for them both did increase too. And I just kind of saw us all as, you know, mucking around on this earth doing the best we could.
Was that because you got to know them better?
I think so. Through
your research and, of course, reading their correspondence?
I think so. Yeah. And I think, again, as Tom Spanbauer would say, having some narrative distance, I could look at them as characters,
rather than parents.
And that, I think that helped too. And it was with my mother, it was almost impossible to have compassion when you were in her presence, when I was in her presence. I mean, she would just undermine that at every instance. She would undermine your ability to feel anything except pulling your hair out rage with her. But and so it was easier to have that space around me to see her as a human being, a suffering human being herself.
You have a beautiful line in the book which kind of describes, I guess, your current state. You write, "This is where I live, somewhere smack between pity and rage, between empathy, the compassion we talked about, and indictment.
Mm-hmm.
And as hard as I look, I still can't find a place to rest between mercy and pain."
Mm. Yeah, I think that I'm moving along in that. I don't think I'm smack in the middle anymore. I think I'm closer to mercy and compassion. But, I mean, I can bring up rage. I can feel it. And I can feel the indictment. I can feel the ways I wish I had a different experience, for sure.
You have a whole chapter on that, what I wish for.
Yes, exactly. All
it's
the
almost
things
this,
I wish for.
This ideal childhood and life that proceeds from that childhood.
Exactly.
Which you didn't have, thanks to Lee and August.
Thanks to Lee and August.
Now, we earlier mentioned one of the epigraphs from the book, the Toni Morrison one. There are four. The last of those four is from Anonymous and reads, "Our parents are the ones who both wound us and administer our bandages." For you, the wounding part is very evident in the book. Was it difficult to remember the times they administered those bandages?
You know, the way I think about that quote is how I often think that families in some way are a bad design. That you've got these individual little creatures that enter into the world and that are their own souls. And then you've got these parents who are the teachers. They are the models. You can't get away from it, you know, until you're quite older. And so there's that friction already between who the child might be and the lessons or that the parents are either implicitly or explicitly passing on to them. So there's a way in which I think about that quote more broadly in that way, that yes, they were doing the damage, but they were also the only ones that we were supposed to turn to for help and support and protection.
The idea of family then probably puts a little too much of a burden on parents who may not be ready to be role models and teachers.
I think so. And at least be always aware that these are separate human beings, separate from us, that come into the world, right?
Yeah, you quoted a line, which I love because he's my one of my comic idols, Albert Brooks.
Oh, yeah.
He had a movie with Debbie Reynolds called Mother, and this is a line you quoted from the book. He returns home as kind of an experiment, and Debbie Reynolds is his mom, and she's a bit imperfect,
<A bit.
laughs> I can say. And his mother tells him, I forget the name of his character in the book. It's not Albert, the movie. But she says she loves him, and he replies, "I know you think you do."
I just love that so much. I love that so much. And I actually bring that up with clients with some frequency, too. I'm positive my mother, in her way of thinking, really loved us. I'm sure she did. She was just capable of only so much. You know, her really diagnostic narcissism only allowed so much thought about other people, you know, taking into consideration anybody else's needs.
And there we get into the role of psychologist here. You just diagnosed your mom.
Right, I did.
As a practicing narcissist. You've been a psychologist now for about 40 years. I was wondering, after reading the book, has your profession helped you to come to terms with your family relationships? We kind of got a little into that. And then how have these relationships affected your work with your clients? Has it made you more understanding and empathetic, or is it more like you think you've got it bad?
No, So let me start by saying that I really believe that most of us who get into this field do so to understand ourselves, to heal ourselves, and to help ourselves along this process that we're also helping other people with. So I think it kind of goes without saying that doing this work for all these years has helped me. I can see even though the particulars of my story might be quite different from somebody else's, everybody's got a story, and you can't measure pain. You know, if a truck runs over your foot, it's going to be really painful, even though you're not, you know, a child soldier in Uganda.
It reminds me of another comic idol, Mel Brooks, to paraphrase, if a truck runs over your foot, it's comedy.
Right, right.
If it runs over my foot, it's tragedy.
Exactly. Bingo. I do have a lot of compassion for all of my clients, almost without exception. There have been like one or two over 40 years that I've had a really hard time digging deep for some compassion for. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's been a synergistic relationship between my work and between my own thinking about my own childhood and my own development and then in writing this book.
You have another quote in the book, which I loved. It was from your Jewish roots here. It was a rabbinical saying on, you talk about narcissism and then what can be considered maybe a healthy narcissism. And the rabbinical saying is, when a child is born, the rabbi says you're to place one piece of paper in each pocket. One reads, "The world is made for you." The other says, "You are but a speck of dust in the universe."
Don't you love that?
I love that because it's a great thing to keep in mind.
It is.
Yeah, we're
great.
Basically self-centered, and we don't see that we are that speck of dust in the universe.
Either that, or we just feel like a speck of dust, and we don't feel like our life is worth the space it takes, or that we don't have a voice. We are not entitled to a voice. I mean, I do think that either one of those poles is problematic, and finding that middle ground. And for people like me who have parents that have been so narcissistic, it's hard to experience anything that feels self-centered as anything but, well, I use this quote in the book as a kind of slippery slope to crazy town.
And you even feel at one point, the context of this rabbinical quote is you feel that even writing a memoir might be considered narcissistic.
Exactly. And I made the mistake of reading a review of somebody else's memoir the other day where the reviewer said, well, inherently writing a memoir is a narcissistic pursuit. So, and I think there's some truth to that. It's like saying, I'm worth the ink, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, you can make a case then that anything that you do that's productive is a narcissistic pursuit.
That's true.
But again, it's the two sides of it.
You're
a speck of dust and you're the center of the universe at the same time.
Exactly. I expect that's going to be a lifelong struggle for me is finding that place. I expect that's going to be.
It's the first I've heard that rabbinical saying, and it's something that I will keep
I think
in
it's
mind.
Pretty great.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it gives you a little perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in your role of a psychologist, say you were your own client, how would you approach the therapy? And maybe you've had clients with similar situations with parents who were somewhat, again, imperfect. And...
Yes. I mean, I think the big challenge, and I think this has been my big challenge and with clients that have similar circumstances, is how hard it is to let go of the wish and desire and illusion that things could be different. That, and this is when my parents were alive, but especially my mother, like if I just XYZ, if she would just ABC, if only something, then I maybe could have the mother I
it's
wanted.
Almost like living a fantasy rather than confronting the reality of the situation.
And that, I think that desire and that illusion dies a very, very hard death. I think it takes a long time and is kind of chipping rock to internalize that. I will never have that. It's gone.
It's a survival response in a lot
it's
of people, isn't it?
Response.
To live in that kind of fantasy.
It
if
is.
Things were a little different, boy.
It is.
I'd have this, like this childhood in Connecticut. And,
right, exactly. Wearing flowered dresses, which I would never wear.
Now, Liz, the last chapter of the book is titled Passover.
Mm-hmm.
You describe a scene from one of your own Passover Seders. It's very appropriate because as we were recording, Passover actually starts tomorrow at sundown. You also, for this Seder, you wrote your own Haggadah, customized Haggadah, which tells the story and significance of Passover. It's traditionally read at the Seder. Now, why did you choose to end this book with this scene?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know it was going to be the end until I wrote it. And then I thought, oh, this is the end. This is the end. And I think the biggest thing there was how, in the Seder that we do spend time thinking about the people that are gone. We do think about ancestors. And I'm just, through that ritual, having a stronger sense of connection to my unknown ancestors, people I never met, and stronger connection to even my parents, and just feeling the lineage. And it just felt satisfyingly like a place to end.
That really is a lot of the story of Passover, is remembering our ancestors who left Egypt, and then the plagues and all that.
Right.
And then it's interesting, the very youngest person at the table asked those four questions: why is this night different from any other?
Right.
And three more, which I don't remember.
Well, I'm a very bad Jew. I don't know any of it. I don't know any of the prayers or anything. And I'm sure our Haggadah would be like, I'm sure rabbis would have a really hard time with it. But Buddha is quoted. And
oh, I like that.
Okay.
I'm going to spend the Seder at your house.
Okay, good.
Now, you started a book tour for This Never Happened. You'll be reading at Powell's, the City of Books, the downtown Portland location, tomorrow, April 23rd. Are you finding that people are identifying with your story and eager to share their perhaps similar experiences?
I am. I'm just starting out on the tour, so but from the people that have purchased pre-order copies, I'm getting a lot of that feedback. That I mean, a lot of people will say this is more extreme than my situation was, but
that's not a bad thing, though. They might think, oh, I have it pretty good.
That's true. That's true. But I think that just the struggle to come to terms with whatever you wish you had but hadn't, didn't, and never would, I think is a somewhat universal theme for people. So, yeah.
And so much, well, there's a lot of pain in there, but there's also a lot of wisdom that we can take away. I found it very healing and therapeutic, even though my parents were quite a bit better.
Oh, well, I'm so glad to
in
hear
my
that.
Memories.
I'm glad to hear that on both counts.
Well, Liz, thanks very much for coming into KABU today.
Thank you
really
so much, Ken.
It.
I've really had a wonderful time. Thank you.
Thanks. We've been talking with Liz Scott, author of the new memoir, This Never Happened, from University of Hell Press. Liz will be reading and signing books at Powell's, the downtown Portland location, tomorrow evening, April 23rd at 7:30. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Liz for visiting us at KABU, and to all of you for listening.